From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's Veterans Day. As the U.S. beats its war drums on Baghdad, sick Gulf War veterans beat on government doors for health benefits and speak out against a U.S. military strike on Iraq. And Democracy Now! Is broadcasting from Los Angeles this week. We'll look at activism from Hollywood to the highways. We'll talk with the Bus Riders Union and deal with struggles from DreamWorks to Universal Studios. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Clinton administration stepped up its threats against Iraq today, ruling out negotiations with the Iraqi government. State Department spokesperson James Rubin says, quote, negotiations are not needed. Another administration official says if the U.S. does strike Iraq, quote, it's not going to be a pinprick. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is increasing its forces in the Gulf. Reuters is reporting that the U.S. today is sending more warships, including stealth bombers. Earlier today, as the U.S. began deploying troops, the United Nations began withdrawing its staff from Iraq. President Clinton yesterday made a flurry of phone calls to leaders of other countries trying to build support for airstrikes, but has found little public support from any country except Britain. The U.S. has historically had little problem with acting unilaterally. We'll have more on this later in the show. The New York Times is reporting that the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, George Tenet, threatened to quit if President Clinton agreed to release convicted spy Jonathan Pollard as part of the Middle East Peace Accord. Citing administration sources, the New York Times said Tenet made the warning after learning Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made Pollard's case a key bargaining point in the peace talks. Tenet and a CIA spokesman both declined comment to the newspaper. The Taliban's chief justice accused the United States today of looking for an excuse to launch another missile attack on Afghanistan. And that excuse is Osama bin Laden, the man Washington calls enemy number one and blames for the August 7th bombings of U.S. embassies in East Africa. On August 20th, the United States retaliated by firing Tomahawk missiles at Afghanistan, killing 26 people. According to U.S. intelligence sources, the camps were being used to train members of bin Laden's group. Washington, which has posted a $5 million reward for bin Laden's arrest, hasn't ruled out further attacks on Afghanistan. This news from Indonesia. Soldiers fired warning shots and struck protesters with rattan canes today during a march toward parliament, where a special assembly allegedly considered how to reform Indonesia's authoritarian political structure. The protesters say many assembly members are holdovers from the Suharto era and lack the will to push through true democratic change. The assembly consists of 475 elected lawmakers, 75 military representatives, and the rest government appointees. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the Dili massacre, where Indonesian soldiers opened fire on Timorese in the capital, Dili, in East Timor, and killed more than 250 of them. Big Tobacco and a group of state attorneys general are close to an agreement under which tobacco companies would pay up to $200 billion over 25 years to settle state claims against the industry. This, according to sources close to the talks. The negotiators were hopeful of reaching an agreement by the end of the week. But both sides cautioned last night that some issues remained unresolved and talks were continuing. Under the pact being discussed, tobacco makers could no longer advertise on billboards, sell merchandise with tobacco brand names, or use cartoon characters like Joe Camel in ads. In exchange, the states would drop suit seeking a reimbursement for what Medicaid programs have spent treating sick smokers and accusing the industry of improperly inducing people to smoke. This news from here in California, there's a new report on the risks posed by agricultural and industrial chemicals on reproduction. Three groups, Physicians for Social Responsibility, the California Public Interest Research Group, and Californians for Pesticide Reform, have scheduled a news conference to release the 180-page report. It reviews hundreds of studies and discusses how widely used chemicals may affect reproductive health in California. And Los Angeles city officials are trying to battle a rise in hate crimes. One recommendation, LAPD officers should be evaluated on how they deal with hate crimes in their area. Command officers are already supposed to prepare an annual plan on their attempts to handle the crimes. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, today and throughout the rest of the week, Democracy Now! Is going to be broadcasting from Pacifica station KPFK in Los Angeles. Later in the show, we'll talk about activism here in Los Angeles. But right now, we look at international and national news. United Nations staff left Baghdad today as the United States began moving more troops to the Gulf in a new standoff with Iraq over weapons inspections. A UN spokesperson in Baghdad said in a statement read to reporters that all non-essential staff are temporarily being relocated as a precautionary measure. Spokesperson Eric Fault said, in view of the uncertainties surrounding the current situation and following instructions from the United Nations headquarters in New York, it's been decided to temporarily relocate non-essential UN staff. UN humanitarian workers who operate the Iraqi Oil for Food program and other aid officials were leaving for Amman, while United Nations weapons monitors were believed to be flying from an Iraqi airport to Bahrain, where a base is located. An Iraqi official said Baghdad had nothing to do with the inspector's departure. Well, today we're going to talk with Gulf War veterans, both about the latest news from Iraq and also about how the United States is dealing with Gulf War illness. Right now, we're joined by Eric Gustafson. He is a Gulf War veteran and founder of Education for Peace in Iraq Center. It's called EPIC. He's returned to Iraq since the war on a humanitarian mission and is currently organizing a delegation of Gulf War veterans to Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Eric Gustafson.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, can you tell us what your assessment is of these latest developments, more battleships going to the Middle East? We see that the UN has pulled out its non-essential staff. What's happening?
It's clear that that high-up senior officials in the U.S. government want to see a military strike on Iraq, and they're willing to play the cards in such a way to ensure that happens. For example, when it comes to diplomacy, the position of, and this is the spokesperson for the Clinton administration, the position of the United States currently is, quote, there's nothing to negotiate. That's clearly a position to ensure that there's only, the only course of action will be a military strike, rather than trying to have a diplomatic solution to the current crisis.
You have a letter to the New York Times today that's been published in the New York Times. Can you talk about your main point there?
Well, first of all, I want to make it clear that that was a huge fight just to get that letter in the New York Times. And I think that it was only because they were in a position where they had to print it that it was printed at all. Basically, the position that I take is when you look at the deaths of over a million under the sanctions, and some place the death toll much higher because we're only talking about documented deaths and placing the number around a million, you know, a military strike is just going to add to that death toll, and it doesn't seem to move us any closer towards disarming Iraq. It does, in fact, it will work against us with that regard because it will ensure that there won't be any more inspections. And, I mean, it's just clear to me that it's that these policies are about killing the people of Iraq and little else. So it's a huge problem that, you know, as far as the present course of U.S. policy in the region.
Why was it so hard to get your letter in the New York Times?
Because it's all that's fit to print, and the New York Times chooses not to cover the humanitarian crisis.
Eric Gustafson, can you talk about how your views have changed over time? After all, you did go to the Persian Gulf as a soldier. What did you do there?
I was in an engineer unit. I was over there for about 8 months, rebuilt hospitals, roads, and all the kinds of construction projects, prisoner of war camps. When I was over there, I was very young, as with most people that go into the military, and I didn't have a very sophisticated understanding of the Middle East, much alone of U.S. foreign policy. That clearly has changed, and I've changed my position regarding the Gulf War, and now really oppose these policies that I see as really killing civilians and violating international law.
How many times have you gone back to Iraq since then, and what is the response of Iraqis to you as a former U.S. soldier there?
Well, I traveled back to Iraq in the summer of 1997, and as was mentioned earlier, I'm forming a delegation of Gulf War veterans that will be traveling again. We're probably looking at February. When I traveled to Iraq last summer, I was received with open arms and hospitality. I was actually really surprised at how warm and open many of the Iraqis were with me, even after finding out that I was an American, you know, from the government that was literally killing their children, and that I was also a veteran that had participated in the war that started it all. So I, you know, there was a family that offered me tea, which is a common hospitality of Iraq, even though it was the last amount of tea that this family had because of their scarce resources. You know, that's the generosity and the warmth of the Iraqi people, and that's not a picture that, you know, the American people really have of the Iraqi people, because everything is always eclipsed by the specter of Saddam Hussein.
We're talking to Eric Gustafson, who is a Gulf War veteran and founder of a group called Education for Peace in Iraq Center, known as EPIC. What do you say, though, to this issue of Saddam Hussein, what the U.S. charges and the United Nations charge, not allowing inspectors to fully inspect the weapons of Iraq?
What I basically say is that if we really want to curtail the regime, then we need to support civil society in Iraq, and that's not what we're doing. We're actually destroying civil society in Iraq. You know, there's no middle class now in Iraq. The professional class, including doctors, professors, are leaving Iraq. So we're actually setting the stage for an even more radical regime than Saddam Hussein is. You know, Dennis Holliday, who's a senior UN official that recently resigned in protest of the sanctions and a failed oil for food program, says that the high-up leaders in the Ba'athist party in the regime are looking over their shoulder at the younger generation that are even more angry, more impatient, and don't even want to see any cooperation with the United Nations. You know, we're hardly planting the seeds of goodwill with these policies. We're actually ensuring that there'll be further devastation, further instability, and, you know, possibly further conflict. You know, what really needs to happen is we need to immediately lift the economic sanctions, and we can continue, you know, military and diplomatic sanctions against the regime, but we must immediately end the humanitarian crisis and lift the economic sanctions on the people of Iraq.
In addition to Eric Gustafson, a Gulf War veteran, we're joined by Chris Cornkvin, who is another Gulf War vet and president of the National Gulf War Resource Center, which is a coalition of 53 grassroots Gulf War veterans groups. Today, President Clinton is going to be signing H.R. 4110, the Veterans Programs Enhancement Act of 1998, relating to medical coverage for veterans of the Gulf War. Until now, if a veteran had an illness, whether it was cancer or a neurological disease, and wanted medical care as a veteran, they were required to file a claim with the Veterans Administration for it to be considered a service-connected disease. The burden of proof rested on the veteran, and an estimated 96% of these claims were rejected by the VA. Chris Cornkvin, talk about this act that President Clinton is signing today and whether you're satisfied with it.
Well, this legislation, along with other legislation that was passed this year, will go a very long ways towards providing what we've been trying to get for the previous 7 years. For 7 years, we've been arguing over what has been causing our illnesses rather than in treating the veterans or providing proper medical care or disability benefits to them and their families. This legislation essentially says, you know, enough is enough. This is what they were exposed to over in the Gulf during their service. It sets up a commission with the National Academy of Sciences, and this commission will study a lot of the illnesses or symptoms or medical conditions, and they will study the toxins that we were exposed to, and they will determine whether there is enough of an indication that, yes, they were caused by exposure to those toxins. And if that's the case, then the commission will make a recommendation that that condition should be service-connected. And by gaining that service-connected designation, then this a Gulf War veteran would then be guaranteed continuous medical care for that condition, as well as disability benefits if they would qualify for those.
Do you suffer from any kind of Persian Gulf illness?
Well, I certainly do. And again, we've all heard of the laundry list of Gulf War veteran symptoms, but it gets a little frustrating hearing how, when they're put that way, how they seem to be somewhat diminished. I mean, I don't believe brain damage, you know, a heart condition, intestinal disorders, and other serious medical issues are you know, some part of a laundry list. I mean, they're very serious medical conditions, and they need to be given the seriousness they deserve. But yeah, it's the neurological conditions, lung damage, et cetera, are what I've been suffering with since I came home.
Chris Corkvin, we're going to keep you on through the second segment because we're going to be joined by two other Gulf War vets who also suffer from Persian Gulf War syndrome. But right now, can you go back and talk about how difficult it's been? What is the route that had to be taken to get to this point today where President Clinton is signing H.R. 4110?
Well, up until, I suppose, 93 or 94, there was some legislation passed that allowed compensation or a designation of service connection due to undiagnosed illnesses. Prior to that legislation being passed, a Gulf War veteran essentially was, if you could get in to the VA to get proper medical care, you would be somewhat taken on a space available basis, meaning you did not have a service-connected designation, so you could get in and get a Gulf War Veterans Registry examination from which they may refer you to other specialists, but there was never a guarantee that you would be able to go to those other specialists or get further medical care because, again, you did not have that service-connected designation. After the undiagnosed illness law was passed, it appeared as if quite a number of veterans were suddenly getting diagnoses for their medical conditions. Now, whether there was an attempt to evade the intent of Congress and that law, that's something we'll never know. But after the law was passed, then Gulf War veterans again continued to attempt to get a service-connected designation from the VA. Again, it was extremely difficult. We went through quite a number of hoops, and you mentioned earlier that 96% of those claims at that time were denied. Even today, there's a very high percentage of claims that are continued to be denied. And when you see the statistics come out, how many are actually service-connected for these conditions, and how many veterans have sought treatment at the VA? I mean, it's really a disparate figure. There are very, very few that are given service connection for these problems. As of today, if a veteran wants to continue to receive treatment or try to receive the service-connected designation, we essentially are having to provide a courtroom standard of proof that, yes, we were exposed to chemical warfare agents, or, yes, we were exposed to depleted uranium. And With that burden of proof being on the veteran, it was extremely difficult for the veteran to gain service connection for those problems.
Chris Corkvin, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and you'll be on with us, but I wanted to give Eric Gustafson one last chance for a final comment and also a chance to give us the contact information for Education for Peace in Iraq Center. And if Gulf War veterans would like to join your delegation going to Iraq, how they can get in touch with you.
Yeah, the phone number is 202-543-6176. It's, again, 202-543-6176. And just a brief comment, today is Veterans Day. which celebrates Armistice Day, which was the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, when we had a peace agreement that stopped World War I with the deaths of over 10 million, one-fifth of which all of those deaths were civilians. And today we live in an era where modern wars oftentimes kill 90% of all the casualties being civilians. And in the case of the sanctions on Iraq, which also are sanctions against ourselves, because every Tomahawk cruise missile that will be fired into Iraq will be $1 million taken away from our communities, or $1 million taken away from health care, you know, is killing 100% civilians. So I hope that the message of armistice will eventually reach the higher levels of our government one day.
Eric Gustafson, thank you for joining us again. That number of Education for Peace in Iraq Center, known as EPIC, is 202-543-6176. And we'll be back with Chris Kornfin, who is the president of the National Gulf War Resource Center, in just a minute. He'll be joined by two other Gulf War vets who are sick today, this on Veterans Day. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. On this Veterans Day, we've been looking at issues that veterans of the Gulf War face. We've been talking with Eric Gustafson, Gulf War vet, founder of Education for Peace in Iraq Center, and also Chris Kornfin, who has stayed on the line with us, Gulf War vet and president of the National Gulf War Resource Center, coalition of 53 grassroots Gulf War veterans groups. It is based in Washington, D.C. We're now also joined by other veterans of the war who are suffering from serious health problems as a result of being exposed to several toxins during the bombing of Iraq. We're joined by Cassandra Garner, who was a member of the 649th Military Police in Iraq during the war and was exposed to seven toxins, including sarin gas. She joins us from the Bay Area in California. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Cassandra Garner.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what has happened to you since you came back from the Persian Gulf?
Since I've returned from the Gulf, I've been extremely sick. I've had to have four operations regarding female problems. There's other female veterans who are dealing with female problems or who have had total hysterectomies. I've had severe migraine headaches, achy joints, a slew of illnesses since I've returned. No one knows, and no one has an answer for me.
Cassandra, what have you done? Who have you turned to?
Initially, when I returned, I sought medical help from the military, and I was basically told that I needed to return home and get into some civilian clothes and take a nice hot American shower, and I would be back to health. And I believed them. You know, I was about 21 at the time, and I felt that the military at the time learned this lesson dealing with the Vietnam veterans and what happened with Agent Orange. So I really believe that they were being forthcoming and honest. And several years later, I got in contact with Dan. And I was just learning a lot of things, depleted uranium. I learned that my unit was in the vicinity when sarin and cyclosarin was released during the Kemisea bombings. The oil well fires, the fumes from the oil well fires, the inoculations, everything. And then I was just totally blown away by the dishonesty and the untruth that I was given from our leaders, you know. And I've been really involved in trying to get the word out and contacting other veterans and seeing, you know, if there's any problems with them or, you know, just exchanging information. There's a lot of things I don't know as far as where we were located. I mean, I know where we were located, but there's other missions we pulled and other areas we were located that I'm not exactly sure. So I've been trying to get in touch with individuals from the unit, and that's been really hard because they've either left the military or, you know, some of them have died or they're just nowhere to be found.
Cassandra Gardner, you mentioned depleted uranium. Chris Kornkvin of the National Gulf War Resource Center, can you explain exactly what depleted uranium was and what its use was in the Gulf War?
Depleted uranium is a waste byproduct of the nuclear enrichment process. And we have quite a few billion pounds of this stuff sitting around in stockpiles in the U.S. And some time ago, someone decided, this would make a very dense, very nice tank armor, or it would make a very nice tank round, because it was an extremely dense metal. It's 1.7 times more dense than lead. So this metal was turned into a different various types of munitions, from tank rounds to A-10 warthog rounds to even sniper rounds. Individual snipers were using DU rounds as well. What happens when a DU round impacts a hard target, such as another armored vehicle, is the DU round itself burns completely through the metal. It burns through metal like a hot knife through butter. It burns upon impact and oxidizes that metal into dust, which is extremely toxic when it's inhaled. And that's where most of the exposures came from during the Gulf War. We've been researching this issue for quite some time. We released a report on this type of exposure last March, in which we estimated up to 400,000 Gulf War veterans could have been exposed to depleted uranium because of the amount that was used over there, and it was over 300 tons, and how very little an individual would have to be exposed to in order to be over the federal limit on intake of depleted uranium.
In addition to Chris Kornkvin, who is actually speaking to us from Wisconsin, again, head of the National Gulf War Resource Center, and Cassandra Garner, another ill Gulf War vet from the Bay Area, we're joined by Keith Boylan, also from the Bay Area, a combat vet from the Gulf War, currently the Persian Gulf Outreach Coordinator for the group Swords to Plowshares, which is based in Berkeley, California, which works with homeless veterans around the country. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Keith Boylan.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me. Actually, Swords is in San Francisco.
Ah, okay. Can you tell us, I assume your story is similar to Cassandra and Chris's in terms of how you're feeling right now?
Completely. When I first came back from the war, it was very similar. I immediately started having problems, which I ignored for quite some time. Finally, about 1995 or 1996, I decided...
What were the problems?
Well, at that point, I had recurring skin rashes and a few other... I had the aches and pains and so on, but it wasn't too debilitating. It's primarily the skin rashes. Then a partner of mine at the time complained of burning and so on during intercourse, which really concerned me. So I felt it was time to go to the VA and become part of the Persian Gulf Registry. And when I arrived and started discussing this with my doctor, I found that that problem was widespread, which really concerned me at that point. Since I've had a lot of things done, which most of them have come back very positive, my skin problem has been diagnosed as pigmented purpura, which essentially is the blood vessels in your skin burst for really no apparent reason, and just you have blotching and bruising all over your skin, which eventually goes away. But I have been service-connected with that, fortunately. But like Chris mentioned earlier, you have to be kind of skeptical about that as well, because the more people they diagnose, regardless of the accuracy, they are no longer part of this mysterious illness known as Guilford syndrome. They're now a diagnosed illness, and it's, you know, taken care of.
Cassandra Garner, you just said exactly. What do you mean? What is the problem when you fought so hard to have it service-connected, and then you say there are problems with even having it that way?
Well, you know, the symptoms are being exposed to sarin and cyclosarin. Although it was at low levels, I have neurological damage where my system, my nervous system just goes totally out of whack. And my neighbors have witnessed it, and my family members have witnessed it. However, when I go to the VA, they'll run a standard EMG, a nerve conduct study, and it comes back negative, which is, I'm happy, but I don't know if that's an accurate reading. Same thing with the migraine headaches. You know, they say they're clustered. They're clustered, and that only older men receive or have the type of headaches that I have. And I'm not an older male, so I don't know what that's about. It's just they'll put a diagnosis on you, and they'll wipe away the undiagnosed illness track or diagnosis, and it's not looked upon as Guilford syndrome. So,
how is it that you got exposed to sarin gas?
Well, I guess the downwind from the bombings. We weren't that far from the border of Baghdad. My understanding, we were about 30 miles away. So I don't think it was that hard. And depending on what was going on at that time, there were wind storms all the time, dust storms, so it's not that hard.
Chris Cornfin, let me follow up on these descriptions of how ill each of you are with a question about the whole nature of war technology now. Has it changed? Is this the first time we're seeing these kind of syndromes?
Well, I don't think necessarily that it's the first time we're seeing these kinds of syndromes. I think the science has advanced at this point in time enough to where we're starting to see more of an indication of what happens when individuals go to war. The war is a very nasty business, and when you go to battle, you're going to be exposed to quite a lot of nasty things. And we, if you look at the legislation that was passed recently, it does include the list of things that we were exposed to. Now, when you take one of those exposures or toxins as an individual, it may not be that hazardous in everyday life. When you're exposed to quite an amount of it, it does start to become hazardous, and then when you're exposed to it in combination with some of these other toxins, it very well could produce some hazardous effects. As far as the chemical weapons exposures from Kamisea, those plants were bombed from the air, and the agents themselves rose up into the air and were pushed south by the weather, where they started coming down over the top of the troops, like Cassandra. Depleted uranium, another issue that has a very long half-life. DU is not like a chemical agent in that it disperses over a short period of time. DU is has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, so it will be there for quite some time. So a soldier going through a certain area on the battlefield where DU was used could very likely become exposed from the resultant dust that is still there on the battlefield.
On this day, Veterans Day, there is a great deal of talk by the U.S. government of having to be proud of veterans, and veterans should be proud. But there is this terrible problem around the country where so many of the nation's homeless are veterans. Keith Boylan, you deal with homeless veterans. Can you talk about the numbers and the particular issues that homeless veterans must face now, and why it is that they're homeless?
Well, I think homeless veterans face a lot of the same problems that people in low-income situations throughout this country face. Unfortunately, there's a lot of transitional problems from military to civilian life, and along with possible battlefield experiences and so on, add to that. I'd say there's been numbers anywhere from 60% to 75% of the homeless in this nation are veterans, which is just frightening. And that definitely holds true in San Francisco.
Well, say that figure again.
60% to 75%
of homeless people.
Of homeless people
are veterans.
That's what the numbers say. Yeah,
pretty astounding.
It's quite frightening, actually. It's very sad. I mean, I think anyone who serves their country, it should be applauded, and it's unfortunate that upon return, many of them find themselves in this situation. SWORDS provides transitional programs, because it was the same deal. When people came back from Vietnam, they were suffering illnesses and all sorts of things, and some Vietnam veterans had transitional problems when they returned, so they developed SWORDS, which now primarily focuses on homeless veterans, and it has housing programs, occupational training, and things of that nature, substance abuse programs. We're hopefully, we won't have the same effect with the Gulf War veterans, but it's still way too early to tell how that's going to pan out as far as if they're going to have the same experience as the Vietnam veterans do. As we know, it's a war that was definitely had a different, I would say, acceptance level nationwide. Mm-hmm. So possibly we won't have the same sort of fallout.
How does the Veterans Administration, the VA, deal with homeless veterans?
Not very well. Not
yeah,
very well at all.
There's
not a whole lot of funding, and there's not very many programs that go into it. They've been supportive of SWORDS.
It just makes me think of Eric Gustafson's last comment in the last segment, Gulf War veteran, talking about every Tomahawk missile that is used in perhaps another bombing of Iraq means $1 million here, that actually more than that, is taken away from support for people.
Well, yeah, in addition, you find it disheartening when you discuss things like Persian Gulf Syndrome and so on, and when people start talking about the cost, the feasibility of cost in the different studies and so on, it concerns me because, you know, being a veteran, I'd like to think that what myself and many other people did was, for whatever reason, will be supported just because it's a decision we had made, and it's not always that way. I mean, recently I spoke with a doctor at the VA on a show out here in San Francisco, and when we were discussing Gulf War syndrome and the issues surrounding, eventually his final reply was, you know, the funding's not there. We don't have the ability for the VA to cover this, and that's scary.
Keith Boylan, we do have to wrap up. Can you give the phone number of how people can get in touch with Swords to Plowshares?
They can call 415-252-4787, and also online it's www.swords-2-plowshares.org.com.
And is that two the number or the word two?
It's two the word.
Swords to Plowshares.
Exactly.
And also, let me get a phone number from Chris Corkman, again, president of the Persian Gulf, the National Gulf War Resource Center.
Yes, our number is 1-800-882-1316, extension 162. And if veterans are looking for information that can help them navigate the VA bureaucracy, we do have some self-help guides that are still available. We're trying to raise funds to print more self-help guides. We've distributed about 15,000 of them so far. They can call that number and get a free self-help guide.
And that number again?
Yes, ma'am. It's 800-882-1316. 1316, extension 162, and our internet web address is www.gulfweb.org/resource_center, and the self-help guide is available on the website as well.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Chris Corkvin, in Wisconsin, head of the National Gulf War Research Center, Keith Boylan, of Swords to Plowshares, and thank you to Cassandra Garner, another ill Gulf War veteran on this Veterans Day. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to where we are right now, which is Los Angeles, and we look at activism here from Hollywood to the highways. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and for the next few days, Democracy Now! Is broadcasting out of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. So we're going to be taking a look in these next few days at activism in Los Angeles. Of all the things LA is known for, Hollywood and traffic are certainly two of them. Today we're going to look at two issues that have been at the forefront of activism in LA: decent living wages in the movie studio industry and public transportation for the city's poorest communities. As movie studios expand their operations in the Los Angeles area to include on-site entertainment such as restaurants and studio tours, they're increasingly bypassing unionized labor and hiring workers at below living wages by using contractual loopholes. In an industry that turns movie stars into millionaires overnight, many recently hired workers are struggling to make ends meet, despite the fact that unions in the movie business have traditionally been strong. Well, yesterday, the LA City Council unanimously voted to revise the living wage ordinance, a move that could benefit many workers in Los Angeles. This ordinance came about 1 year ago after intense lobbying by a large coalition of activists known as the Living Wage Coalition. We're joined now by Madeline Janice Aparicio, who is executive director of the LA Alliance for a New Economy, known as LANE. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Madeline.
Thank you, Amy.
Well, tell us about this victory in the L.A. City Council.
Well, L.A., like a number of cities across the country, is really suffering from the consequences of, you know, this huge growth in the disparity between the wealthy and the poor, and in particular, the growth of the working segment of working poor. L.A. has about 36% of the people who work in our county earn less than $15,000 a year, which is the poverty level for a family of four. So we have this enormous population, and, you know, we're in a county of more than 9 million, so we're talking about millions of people. So there, L.A., like cities across the country, is really part of this new growing movement called the living wage movement. And last year, the city council passed our living wage ordinance, which says that companies that do business with the city, like, for example, Trizicon, who's building the new Academy Awards Theater in Hollywood, and companies that contract with the city have to pay their workers what we call a living wage, is really actually on the low side of a living wage, but $7.39 an hour plus family health benefits and some days off and things like that. And when the ordinance passed about a year ago, about 80 airlines actually joined together and challenged the city's application of the ordinance to the airports. And there's about 3,000 workers at LAX and other LA airports that provide very essential services like screening passengers and assisting disabled passengers, et cetera. And those workers began organizing and trying to form a union and demanding their rights under the living wage, and the airlines really drew a line in the sand. So yesterday, the city council unanimously passed an amendment to the ordinance that makes it clear that the airlines are covered, that workers who organize are protected. And yesterday's vote was even more dramatic than last year in a lot of ways, because we had even the most conservative Republicans on our council who really have become convinced that a living wage is the right thing and it's not going to destroy our city, and in fact it's going to, you know, benefit everybody.
Can you talk about how you succeeded in getting this through in this kind of very broad coalition that is just very obvious in coming to L.A. and talking to activists, that perhaps in more than any other city, you really have a networked system of grassroots groups here?
Well, we really see ourselves as building a long-term movement. We don't see our purpose as getting one piece of legislation passed or anything else. So we've built long-term relationships with policymakers like City Councilmember Jackie Goldberg and other elected officials. And then we've built a coalition that is fundamentally rooted in organizing and workers really being the lead. So people who are directly affected really being up front and telling their stories and being involved. And then clergy, and part of the original campaign, the result was the formation of a group called the Clergy and Laity United for Economic Justice, CLU, which now includes over 200 churches and synagogues and parishes from all over the city who have a broader economic justice agenda to support worker organizing and issues of economic justice. And then really bringing together community-based organizations that work in low-income neighborhoods together with the newly revitalized labor movement. And, you know, L.A. has really been at the forefront of the new labor movement. There are several unions, especially in the service sector, but also in other sectors, that have developed new leadership over the past 5 or 10 years of mostly Latino immigrant, oftentimes women, almost always people of color, low-income leadership. And those unions have really been also at the forefront of this new movement. And because we have really groups who have a long vision, it's helped us to sort of keep our eye up and on the big picture, and then to, you know, build and put the time and effort and energy to do, for example, what we did yesterday, which was have 300 people and have a unanimous vote.
In addition, Madeline Janice Aparicio, to the Living Wage Campaign, the LA Alliance for a New Economy, your group, as well as Agenda and other groups in Los Angeles, have been involved with a struggle around DreamWorks. When I came into the airport yesterday and was driving toward Venice, we went through the Playa Vista area, which is where DreamWorks is beginning to build an enormous multi-billion dollar development. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, we're part of a group called the Metropolitan Alliance, which brings together groups from all over the city that is fighting to really hold DreamWorks accountable for about a $90 million subsidy they're getting from the city of L.A. to build this new studio. And it's actually, I think, the largest plot of undeveloped land in the city of L.A. It's quite a large piece of land. And there's going to be an enormous development that's going to go in there, including this new studio. And the Metropolitan Alliance has been organizing for, I think, a couple of years now to achieve some really serious commitments from DreamWorks to actually support the establishment of a multimedia training academy for inner-city youth, and that really gives people from low-income communities access to these jobs, to the higher-paying, the more skilled jobs, and gives them the training to get there, as well as things like, compliance with the living wage ordinance and, you know, creation of a development that really contributes to community development, contributes to the development of the whole city.
I see in Variety magazine that it looks like the mayor and the movie guys will be meeting in court, and that one of the minority partners in the Playa Capital Partnership that's building the $1.5 billion Playa Vista development sent a four-page letter to the L.A. mayor, Richard Reardon, which states that the city and city officials are forcing Playa Capital to make a gift of land to DreamWorks. He says they're paying something like, Spielberg, Katzenberg, and Geffen Studios, $15 million for the land, which is worth somewhere around $150 million.
Well, I think the whole issue of public subsidies is really an interesting mixed bag. And I think that's one of the things that in our movement we've seen as a tool to really build power for communities, power for workers, to really change the terms of the debate. So in the DreamWorks situation, for example, the Metropolitan Alliance is really organizing around that public subsidy and trying to leverage that and condition that. We're doing that in many other contexts. And, you know, we're seeing it was on the front page of Time magazine, this last issue, the whole question of corporate welfare. And in L.A., it's, you know, alive and well and, you know, controversial because oftentimes the companies that get subsidies are the ones that least need it. And oftentimes the subsidies that are given out are really taking away from, for example, other services. So it's an important issue, and obviously there are controversies between the developers, for example, in the city, as you mentioned.
Right. Well, in addition to Madeline Janice Aparicio of the LANE, Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, we're also joined by an organizer from the Bus Riders Union. In a metropolitan area where over 90% of the population doesn't use public transportation but instead gets around by car on LA's vast network of freeways, poor communities have seen the city's bus system go from bad to worse. Overcrowding, poor service, frequent price increases have plagued the nation's second largest bus system, which was run by Los Angeles's Metropolitan Transportation Authority, known as the MTA. While the city has done little to improve the quality of service, a powerful coalition of local politicians has managed to persuade the city to set aside millions of dollars for the building of a rail system, which critics say would not service LA's poorest communities. The desperate need for public transportation for the city's hundreds of thousands of bus riders, many of them poor and working class, led to the creation of an extraordinary group called the Bus Riders Union, made up of grassroots organizers working in LA's most marginalized communities. The union sued the MTA for civil rights violations, accusing the system of discriminating against the poor and communities of color. In 1996, the MTA settled the suit, promising to improve bus service and reduce overcrowding. But just recently, the MTA has admitted it's still massively out of compliance with the federal court order. Rita Burgos is with us, who is an organizer with the Labor Community Strategy Center, organizer for the Bus Riders Union. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
This is a very unusual group. Again, Bus Riders Union. It's not an actual union.
Well, it's not an official labor union, but for us, it's a very strong union in that it brings out the history of the militancy of the term union. For us, the bus riders, the public transportation, is one of the central places to organize in this city, where it's one of the few areas where you actually have a multiracial working class, the poorest of the poor in the city. There are two worlds in this city, one that uses public transportation and one that doesn't use public transportation. For 350,000 daily bus riders, this is their life. This is their life of being on the bus for 2 hours. And this population is significantly people of color. So one of the central components of our work has been asserting the centrality of anti-racism as part of our organizing work, that the reason why public transportation and public services is being dismantled is for a variety of different reasons: the corporatization of government, the downsizing of any kind of public infrastructure for the poor. But one of the reasons it's facilitated is that people who are actually on the buses, the immigrant, blacks, working people, poor people, are so demonized that it becomes easier to essentially dismantle the public infrastructure that serves these folks.
I've heard about some very creative tactics that the Bus Riders Union has used. For example, when a bus is filled, can you talk about what strategies the group is using?
Well, we launched a No Seat, No Fare campaign. The campaign is called Don't Pay for Racism, No Seat, No Fare. And it was in response to our civil rights consent decree that we signed in 1996, where the MTA was mandated to reduce overcrowding. Obviously, they did not reduce overcrowding, and they said they were over 90% in violation on the majority of their lines. So what we did was we launched a proactive campaign to say, not only are you in violation, but we're not going to pay our fares. So interestingly, when we've been getting on the buses, we have managed to amass support approximately 80% of the drivers, that a good percentage of the drivers have been supportive. And the kind of tactic of no seat, no fare is a way for us to really shape the debate, to say not only can you not talk about fare increases, but we are asserting that this is our terrain, the bus is our terrain, and we are fighting at many levels on the buses, negotiating with the MTA at the political level.
So you can get on the bus and not pay a fare if you don't get a seat.
That's what we're asking our members to do.
I also heard about the using police tape to wrap up a bus that was too full.
Yeah, that's what we did. We right now, the MTA has the oldest bus system in the whole entire country, although we won a recent victory that essentially is going to transfer about $350 million back to the poor in Los Angeles to replace the oldest bus fleet in the country. It's only the first stage of the victory because we have much, much more, probably approximately $1.5 billion more we need to win. But what we did was we stopped buses in the street. We had about 60 of our members at a series of direct actions throughout the city as a build-up to our No Seat, No Fare campaign. It was our campaign called Declaring Buses Dead on Arrival. And so when a bus would come that was old, that was decrepit, that already passed the MTA's own replacement standard, we would stop the bus, wrap it with homicide tape, and stamp it with No Seat, No Fare stickers.
And would people be allowed to get out of the bus?
Oh, sure. We would let people out of the bus. We'd certainly have people holding the bus there.
So what about the whole issue of buses versus subways? Unlike in a lot of metropolitan areas in the country, you have a very small subway system. And it's only, well, this is actually similar also to Washington, D.C. It goes only to certain areas.
Yeah. In a city that is Los Angeles' size, there is no justification for building a massive subway system. There is not enough density in the city to justify any major subway construction. We are both organizing low-income communities of color, the disabled and the elderly, but we are transit planners, meaning that we are grassroots transit planners for the entire region. And in our estimation, that buses are the central regional transportation mode that is needed in Los Angeles. And right now, we have an alliance of political officials. Interestingly, a lot of liberal Democrats and Democrats of color who are essentially raiding the bus system to fund public to fund their rail projects at the expense of the poorest of the poor, at the expense of communities of color.
Well, Rita Burgos, can you give us the phone number of the Labor Community Strategy Center and the Bus Riders Union?